The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Well, science says you can't know the truth, but in the Bible is a person speaking in the first person as if he is God, saying, "Who has created these things?" Can you begin to believe in this modern space age technological world of ours that there is a great creator God, a literal spirit being who lives in a specific place? People are more incredibly disillusioned, frustrated, and defeated than ever before today. And more, it's a time of opinion sharing, of haranguing and nagging and arguing. It seems that the media of public communications are going more and more into the idea of allowing Mr. and Mrs. Joe Citizen to express their opinions over the airwaves. And more, you're getting a good look into all of the hatreds and the bigotries, the closed-minded arguments, the defeatism, the frustration that nags and enervates and worries the minds of people today. And more, every time you see someone who mentions the name of God and who claims to be religious or to stand upon religious principles, someone else immediately flares up and says, "What is this God you talk about? Is this God black or white? Is this God able to be seen? Have you ever seen this God?" Immediately, of course, then the religious person begins to stammer and try to get across an answer. "Well, of course, I can't see God because God is invisible." "Well, then you haven't proved there is a God," would say the skeptic. And, of course, about this time, the skeptic is all hot under the collar, and there's a big excited furor and a fight going on. And so the religious person feels like he's backed into a corner and has absolutely no answers. Now, certainly the average layman is pretty much convinced by the pressure of intellectualism and science today that the existence of a God has been disproved. I find many, many students who just assume that certainly science has disproved there is a God. In a series of programs then on The World Tomorrow that I have gone through time and again on these seven proofs that God exists, I have come to the sixth major proof. And as I have progressively come through this series of programs on the seven absolutes, the seven positive proofs that there is a great God, the mail, of course, that comes in illustrates the wide variety of thought and opinion on the subject. As many people write in for the booklets on Does God Exist and the proof of the Bible that I've announced continually, once in a great while, of course, I get a letter from an agnostic, a skeptic, an atheist, but oftentimes they're from a university or a college student who will defend, as a frustrated she-bear deprived of her cubs, the idea of evolution, and who will exalt and hold up as if it is his sort of a pseudo-god, such men as Huxley or Darwin and on, some of the fathers of the evolutionary theory, and will say that why all of this has been disproved and be just really tragically upset and really unnerved with me. Because I get dogmatic, and I say, "You can prove these things." And I say, "You can absolutely demonstrate there is a God." And once in a while, a university student will take great exception to this and say, "You can't do anything of the kind." So in a series of articles coming along every single month in the Plain Truth magazine are some of the most red-faced, embarrassing admissions that you will ever see in all of your born days. And the truth is that these eager and overzealous young college students have not seen these admissions, that many of these people are eagerly studying to get a degree in some technical field of science so they can go to work in the teaching field themselves or in one of the vast pharmaceutical companies or as a researcher for a chemical firm or as an explorer for an oil company, and they're studying paleontology and uniformitarianism and they're studying geology and all the rest of it. They're eagerly gulping it all down, hook, line, and sinker, trying to get their degree. But they haven't seen these red-faced, blushing, hideously embarrassing admissions of the very fathers of the evolutionary theory whose doctrine they try to support. And what a lot of you evolutionists and agnostics may not realize is you're standing in the middle of an absolute flood on a rickety platform shot through with holes, crawling with worms, and about two last little pieces of it are flimsily holding together. And you're about to be swept under. that there is a massive avalanche of truth to the contrary that absolutely disproves evolution. And that is a fact, and I can back it up in black and white and colorful print, and you can have it every single time you read one of these articles in the Plain Truth magazine on the subject, or if you have the courage to do more than a lot of people do. A lot of people, of course, merely use the most ancient dodge that is known to man. It must have been used, certainly, by Eve in her first argument with Adam. She probably said, "Who does he think he is?" And there were only two of them on the earth. And so the first human being dodges behind the old argument. Look, if I don't agree with you, I don't like you, and therefore I simply defame your person, or I say, "Who do you think you are?" And I turn my nose up in the air, and a lot of other acidic, rather uncomplimentary commentary comes out of my mouth, and I go on in my own sort of self-deluded conceit, and I assume that therefore I've dispensed with that fellow real quickly. He couldn't know what he's talking about because I don't like him. Well, of course, that's hardly the spirit of science that a lot of these scientists themselves seem to exalt. Now, unless you have proved it for yourself, then I suppose you could say that you're still welcome to your opinion, but I really take exception to that statement. I wonder if a person really is welcome to his opinion, if his opinion is based upon nothing. Now, maybe we, let's say, are able to express our opinion, sure, because we're a free moral agent. We're able to vociferously stand for our opinion, but as to being welcome to it, well, that's something else again. Now, if you have proved one way or the other and you feel that you've really researched it, then, of course, you need not fear the booklets and the articles I'm talking about because you will feel that you're way ahead of them and you'll understand them. If you haven't proved them, then you need them very badly because obviously you're one of those who has been listening to other people and letting other people do your thinking for you and you haven't looked into it for yourself yet. You've always just assumed that the weight of majority numbers or the weight of opinion of other people is sufficient for you to decide. So you need to write for these booklets and articles on Does God Exist and the Proof of the Bible, the article that comes along automatically on seven proofs God exists. Now in this series of programs, I covered the first great law, the first great proof, and that is the existence of unshakable, absolute law, the existence of incredibly complex laws that live and that act upon us, laws that regulate the entirety of the universe, the solar system, the earth and everything upon it. And to isolate that one broad, that one vast subject all by itself is virtually impossible because obviously it overlaps into every one of these other proofs. But the existence of law, the incredible dependability of law, is in itself the absolute proof to any logical and questing mind that there had to be a great lawgiver. Now, one young university student sought to give you the scientific explanation of what is a law. And completely bamboozled and hoodwinked by the continual assault upon everything that he might have called knowledge on the part of science, it must have been like the Chinese grip torture. It finally wore him down. This young fellow had finally decided that in his view, the statement of law was merely the observation of a man, that a man observed that a ball went up and came down, and that he observed it 6, 8, or 12, or 100 times, and so he assumed that if he wasn't making a mistake, and if all the facts were in, that eventually the ball would come down again, the chances were if he threw it up another time. And then he backed off and said, therefore, laws are observations of man about the probability of this or that. Oh, come on. That's a little silly. There's no probability to that. That's absolute. And you can't break it. Now, because a man is so dumb that he sits there and he can't realize that he's proved something infallibly, that he does not infallibly believe. You know, I'm talking right now from the studio in Pasadena, California, and so I have a fantastic faith. I believe Australia is still there. I believe that people in Australia are, so far as the way they view it, right side up. But so far as the way I view it from where I am, they're upside down. I believe that they are clinging to the earth, that they are held, affixed to the earth, that they are pulled down to the earth by the law of gravity, and I depend upon the law of gravity, and I do not call the law of gravity something that science has observed. It wouldn't matter to me whether all of science had spent all of its billions in a studied, concerted effort to preach to you that there is not any law of gravity. I would still believe there is. Science labeling a thing does not make it true or untrue. And laws are absolute, and they are dependable, and you can depend upon them. And the laws that regulate peace, that would produce happiness and productivity, the laws involving even morality, the laws of spiritual laws, you might call them, laws that you might not know one thing about, and yet they may be breaking and bending you and wrecking your life because you're breaking and bending them, and you don't know it. And that is a fact. You don't have to know the law of gravity any more than a six-month-old child has to know it when he tumbles off the bed, any more than a 18-month toddler has to know it when he stumbles over the curb and bangs his head real good. He couldn't define for you what Newton did, but the law of gravity wallops him. He doesn't have to study it. He doesn't have to understand it. It's there. It acts upon him. It's dependable. Don't kid yourself that a law is something man observes, and therefore you can relegate law to the area of something man possesses, or that man has discovered, or that man controls, because laws control man. It doesn't happen the other way around. The existence of law is the demand to any logical scientific mind that there had to be a lawgiver. Now, the next great proof that I gave is that of life. Life exists. You are here. This temporal chemical existence we call life that is so tragically short, that is so easily taken from us. It exists. And life, so far as you can know, and so far as all science proves, comes from pre-existing life. And that is a law. It's called the law of biogenesis. Bio meaning life, genesis meaning beginning, the law of the beginnings of life. That life comes from pre-existing life. And that, believe it or not, in all of your experience, whether you're dealing with fungi or with yeast spores flying about through the air, or the ones that are right now on the tip of your nose, or the ones floating on the top of your cup of water, or whether you're dealing with growing vegetation or animals or insects or humankind, life comes from pre-existing life, and there is a cycle to life. And life demands a life giver, and that's an absolute proof. Now, the third major proof is that of the creation. The very fact of the existence of things, the three laws of thermodynamics, of the conservation of energy, of the preservation of matter, the fact that science absolutely proves that there is no past eternity of matter, that it had an origin. It came into existence at one time. And the world is like a giant clock. And so is the universe and the solar system that is gradually running down. And so the fact of the creation is the great third proof that there is a God. And you'll have all of these in a real brief summarization in the article on seven proofs that God exists. And also you will have various aspects of each one of the proofs broken down, but in very colorful, illustrated form and very readable form, that we're getting all kinds of comments from readers about how their children enjoy it, how they're getting class lessons for school out of it. Exciting pictures, fantastic close-ups, like the one of a recent number that showed the birth of a baby dolphin under the water, and like the one in the current number about the ants. Leafcutter ants, ants that go out and herd their own cattle, ants that make military alliances, ants that deliberately subject themselves to slavery at the cost of their own colony, and this has given rise to some of evolution's most absolutely embarrassing admissions, and you will see those admissions in this article, Evolution Yells Uncle at the Ants. You'll see why. And you'll see what Charles Darwin said. I could give you a little bit of a teaser on it. He said that people would think he was a little silly for still clinging to his theory in the face of these seemingly incontrovertible facts, in different words, but just about the essence of what he said. Now, you will see that admission in this current number of the Plain Truth magazine, if you write for it. Now, also then, in addition to the fact of the creation demanding a creator, you come up with the sustaining of all things, with the utter dependability of such things as you're hearing right now. Radio waves, electronics, the cleavage properties of minerals, as I've said, the chemical properties of matter, such as the laws of chemistry and of physics, the laws that involve physical health, the laws that act upon you all the time. What keeps them going? How do they act in such an utterly dependable fashion? What great law is there that says a law is a law? This is getting at the heart and the pith of the problem. What is it that keeps it active?
Why does gravity continually act the way it does? What about the magnetic field of the Earth? What about the orbital pattern of it? What about the Van Allen belt? What about the facts that regulate the universe, the laws that regulate it? It causes a great question. How is it sustained? The Bible claims by the word of his power, all these things are sustained. And it demands a sustainer to any logical mind. Now, the next great proof that I took a great deal of time upon, and which in the Plain Truth magazine many of the articles concern themselves with, is the proof of a designer. You have never seen an ugly sunset. You've never seen an ugly mineral. You've never seen, the closer you look at the material creation, you've never seen chaos and confusion, but only harmony, interdependability, complexity, perfection. You don't see chaos. You don't see destruction. You don't see disorderliness. Instead, you see absolute order and beauty. The closer you look at what man has done, the more confusion. You can illustrate that perhaps by a simple little magnifying glass at home. Draw a mark with a pencil on a piece of paper and look at it under a magnifying glass, or look at a piece of printed matter on a page, and you will see it's a series of little tiny dots. And the closer you look, the more imperfections you're going to see in it. It's like an oil painting. I can illustrate it that way, that the closer you look at a lot of oil paintings, and of course the wilder they are, the truer this is. Of course, some of them you can look at a half mile away to make you dizzy, but I'm talking about some that are called good art. The closer you look at them, the more splotches and sort of blobs of paint and indefinable, indiscernible splashes of color you see. But the farther away you get up within reason, halfway across the room, why, the more you tend to see something that really isn't there. Your mind just imagines you see a beautiful, verdant, pastoral scene, perhaps. This isn't true in nature, what we call nature. The closer you look at a feather, the little barbicules, the little interlocking members of it, the closer you look at it, the more perfection you see. The closer you look at even a blob of matter, a piece of wood, a little amoeba, a little tiny spirochete or some kind of a germ or a microbe, the closer you look at a mineral, the more intricate perfection you see. The closer you look at the wing of a fly or a leaf of a plant, the more perfection you see. All of it in great and fathomless design. Now, a designer, that's the fifth major proof, absolutely is required. It requires a designer. Now, the sixth major proof that I've come to, I want to cover in this broadcast today, and then also we'll have articles on this coming along in the Plain Truth magazine. So if your name is on the mailing list, you will be sure of getting it ahead of time. The sixth major proof of the Bible is obviously one that the evolutionists would never admit is true because they'll never listen to it, and that is the proof of fulfilled prophecy. Many, many prophecies have already been fulfilled. Now, to this, some bigoted young religious bigot or prejudiced anti-religious bigot would say, oh, you can't tell me prophecies have been fulfilled, because he says we know that the prophets wrote long after the events occurred. Now, that's kind of dumb, because it's not proved, and because higher criticism proves otherwise, and because biblical scholars have proved otherwise, and because you can absolutely, for example, substantiate the dates during the reigns of certain kings of Israel and Judah and of Babylon, of Egypt, and so on, that many of these prophets wrote. And you can see how by their own admission, and this is internal evidence, in their own writings, they admit when they wrote. And you can see how others admit the same thing, and it's all put together in an absolutely interrelated web of factual knowledge. And you can come to see that many of these prophets wrote of future events. Now, for instance, nobody, I mean nobody, in his wildest imaginings, if you are one of these skeptics, ever assigns Daniel to after the fall of the Roman Empire, does he? You say that Daniel wrote, and he was thrown into the lion's den during Nebuchadnezzar's reign, remember? You say that Daniel then wrote after the fall of the Roman Empire, and yet he foretold it. And he not only foretold that, but he foretold the rise and the fall of many others and a weak revival in World War II, and yet a future revival of it to come in our day. Now, some skeptic saying to you that Bible prophets wrote after the events occurred is either quite, the only word I can think of is dumb, or misinformed, or just prejudiced. Let's put it that way. But you don't need to be prejudiced, neither misinformed, nor I won't use that other word. You can find out for yourself, and it's about time you shook the cobwebs out of your head and blew the dust off your Bible and began to prove it for yourself one way or the other. I'm not telling you to believe what I say. I'm not trying to pressure you into believing it through fear or through emotionalism or anything of the kind. I'm telling you, don't believe me. Believe what you see proved. The Apostle Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ. So don't make the mistake of believing anybody you hear until you prove it. Don't believe me, believe the Bible. Believe what you see proved. You can prove Bible prophecy has been fulfilled. Let's take one of the major focal points of all of Bible prophecy. The resurrection of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Apply a little bit of logic to it. Now, first of all, suffice it to say that there are literally more than one dozen specific prophecies, and there are dozens by inference, but there are more than one dozen tangible, specific prophecies that led to the first part of the ministry, that is, the physical ministry of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Every one of them interlocked and depended upon other major prophecies. They had to do with the reign of Cyrus, a Persian king. They had to do with the Babylonian captivity and the return from it on the part of the Jews during the time of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel. It had to do with the reign of Herod, with the time of the building of the temple, with the birth of Jesus Christ, with his sojourn into Egypt, with exactly the city in which he would be born, and then another city in which he would be reared and educated, and then where the major part of his ministry would occur. It had to do with the time of his death, the length of time in the tomb, and the fact of his resurrection. All of these prophecies and many more were fulfilled, and even pagan Roman historians attest to the fact of the first appearance of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. There is no more concretely proved central fact of all history than the fact of the first coming of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Now, what about his resurrection? People deny it, and yet it was absolutely fulfilled prophecy, and the prophecies about a future resurrection hinge upon it. Did he really rise from the dead? Now, if he didn't, let's use a little bit of logic. You've heard practically every story there is, I imagine, by now. Some people have said, oh, his disciples secreted his body away and went out and buried it someplace else. All right, let's reason a little bit together. What happened to his disciples? Well, tradition has it that Peter was crucified upside down. That may or may not be true. I'll tell you one thing for sure, that you can absolutely prove Peter was never in Rome. Well, there was a Peter there, all right, but he was a man who also was named Simon, but he was one of the magicians and the ones who were called the Magi that were of a different sect, and this bears looking into. If you wanted to find all about that Simon, you'd have to read the 8th chapter of the book of Acts and a little bit of history about him, and that would be a shocking study all by itself. But suffice it to say, the disciples in the main were martyred. James, the brother of John, was beheaded. And there were many bloody martyrdoms that occurred. Here was Stephen, who became an evangelist. He was first ordained as a deacon in the church, you see, in the 6th chapter of the book of Acts, and very quickly he begins to preach and perform great miracles, and so he's stoned to death. One after another, these people were murdered. They were butchered. They were sawn in two. They were torn asunder. The 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews catalogs many of the horrible persecutions that came upon these people. Well, then, do you mean to tell me that mature, and in many cases married, human beings with families went out and allowed themselves to be butchered for that which they knew to be a deliberate hoax, a deliberate falsehood? Do you mean to say they went out and faithfully gave their lives in dedicated service when it didn't get them one thing? What did it get them? It didn't get them more money. They gave up homes and families. It didn't get them material benefits. They lived like so many gophers in caves oftentimes. It didn't get them any popularity. They were defamed, spit upon, and ridiculed by most of the Roman world of that day. It didn't get them any longevity of life. It didn't get them any high office in government. It got them absolute persecution and ultimate death. You mean to say they went out and gave their lives for something they knew to be a deliberate hoax? Well, it's ridiculous for any logical thinking person to believe that his own disciples stole his body. Well, did his enemies then steal it? Now, wait a minute. Which ones? The Jews or the Romans? Well, now, apply a little bit of logic to that. If they had, do you believe for one moment they would not have displayed that body? You probably saw The newsreel pictures of Mussolini's body and that of his mistress hanging upside down on the parapet of a filling station up there in Como, in the northern area of Italy, at World War II's close. Do you think for one moment a similar public display of the body of Jesus Christ would not have been affected by the might of the Roman army, and that that body would not have been carefully preserved, and that you could not visit the place where they would cheerfully display for you the body of Christ if the Roman soldiers had unearthed it, had spirited away the body? What if the Jews had done it? Do you think the same thing wouldn't apply? Would not they have displayed that body? Now, I'll use a little logic for another little bit of reasoning. Could it be that Christ wasn't really dead when they buried him, that he came alive again while he was inside the tomb? Well, by the testimony within the Gospels themselves, it said that that was such a giant, heavy door, it would have taken several strong soldiers to have removed it. Could a man who was beaten within an inch of his life, lying there draining the life's blood out of his body, and having fainted in a dead faint, have lain there for the better part of 3 days and three nights, and then mustered enough strength to not only burst all of his bonds, and he was wrapped from head to foot in grave clothes, but also to have removed a great giant stone that even strong, muscular soldiers couldn't remove without plenty of help? Well, now, why is it also that the disciples themselves did not want to believe in the resurrection? And now Jesus Christ had to rebuke them and to say, "Oh, slow to believe all that was spoken of me in the prophets." Why is it they didn't want to believe it? They didn't accept it. Why is it the proverbial story you've heard of doubting Thomas, that they even had to investigate the spear wound and the holes that the nails or the spikes made in his hands and his feet before they would believe? And even then they sort of giggled and laughed and were so incredulous they couldn't really accept it. Oh no, my friends, you can absolutely prove, even by logic, that Jesus Christ of Nazareth was resurrected from the grave. Now the Christian world supposedly celebrates that, where the Bible doesn't command it, and even conceals the exact moment of it. Ostensibly, millions of people believe it. Others claim, well, maybe it was just ecstasy, a sort of a dream, but is that true? Do people who don't want to believe it dream it? Do 500 people at one time in a great large group suddenly dream the same dream at the same time? And why is it that the book of Luke tells that these same disciples believed it was an idle tale at first? They're not going to dream up something or conjure up something like a mass hallucination when they don't expect it. And as Peter said, "I go fishing," well, forget about it, I'm going to go fishing and back to my job. There's no use going on with it. It's all over. Oh, no, you can't explain it that way. Fulfilled prophecy is replete in the Bible. It's all through the Bible. And there are prophecies that not only were fulfilled, but are being fulfilled. And when you write for this booklet, The Proof of the Bible, you're going to find prophecies about Ashkelon, Ashdod, Tyre, Sidon, Babylon, Egypt, Rome, city-states, empires, kings, that not only were fulfilled in the past, but are being fulfilled and are about to be. And fulfilled prophecy is the sixth of the seven major proofs that there is a great, all-wise, divine creator being that knows your thoughts, the hair on your head, and gives you every breath of air you breathe. Write for these booklets by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Request also the booklets on 1975 in prophecy, and be sure to get the Plain Truth magazine, as I've mentioned all through this program. It's free of charge, no price. Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your radio station. That's important. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.